This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, on Wednesday before Thanksgiving last week and after our show on Wednesday morning. President Trump did something that was long overdue. He brought the saga, the legal saga of General Michael Flynn to an end by pardoning General Flynn as he was still embroiled in D.C. courts because of the absurdity of a federal district court judge named Emmett Sullivan refusing to accede to federal prosecutors' decision to drop the charges against Michael Flynn, as you remember. It was a four-year-long saga for General Flynn that should have never happened. In point of fact, there's a good editorial in National Review, and it includes things that don't really need to be said, don't really need to be delved into that much in terms of the abuse of power that General Flynn's prosecution represented. But it's worth noting anyway, a National Review editorial board, you don't have to be a fan of how Trump wielded his pardon power or believe that Flynn was a good choice for national security advisor or has conducted himself prudently and honorably the last several years to acknowledge that this was an abuse of power. He should have never been the subject of an FBI investigation. The FBI's behavior in interviewing Flynn was reprehensible, and the pardon restores the appropriate balance of prosecutorial power, which was put askew by the misconduct of federal district court judge Emmett Sullivan. Sidney Powell was on Lou Dobbs over the holiday weekend, getting Lou Dobbs getting reaction from Michael Flynn's counsel, Sidney Powell, to the news of the pardon.
If the justice system had worked properly, we would not have had to have gotten this pardon, but we certainly appreciate President Trump giving it to General Flynn because this has gone on far too long. We now know that Judge Sullivan was just a political ploy. He's made a political game out of all of this, and it's just one of the most egregious injustices I've witnessed in American history.
Wall Street Journal opining over the weekend, the Flynn pardon was necessary. This is Kim Strassel. To correct a corrupt FBI, a rogue special counsel, an unprincipled federal judge, and an embarrassingly complicit media. I mean, this really should be remembered, what happened to General Flynn, and to borrow from the National Review, whether you like him or don't, whether you think he was a good pick for NSA or you don't, whether you think he has conducted himself appropriately in the intervening years as this prosecution has wound its way around to that point of pardon last week or not. It's worth remembering this story because it was the perhaps the quintessential example of the weaponization of top law enforcement against an incoming presidential administration purely based on politics and a desire to nullify the outcome of an election, in this case, the 2016 election.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636, type in DA. Then a quick comment. Yeah, they attacked him because he's one of the first supporters of President Trump. He was a loyal ally. And remember, he was out there all the time, out campaigning with him. And so that they thought they would get him on, you know, they baited him basically to lie. He got the date wrong, right? Wasn't that it? He got the date wrong when the FBI came and asked him a question.
The McCabe didn't believe that that Flynn was lying. The special counsel knew the Steele dossier was a fabrication, that Flynn was not colluding with the Russians in any way, shape, or form. They continued regardless. As going back to Kim Strassel, the FBI had spent months monitoring him as part of its Russian collusion fantasy, yet by January 4th of 2017, it had found nothing and moved to close its case and rushed Peter Strzok to keep the investigation open. The FBI had snooped on a Flynn call to then-Russian ambassador to the U.S., perfectly legal. Ask Joe Biden's team, which is making such calls right now. The FBI nonetheless debated a ludicrous Logan Act charge before settling on a simpler course to get, as counter-intel head at FBI Bill Priestap noted in one of his handwritten notes, get Flynn to lie so we can prosecute him or get him fired. That was the point. Mueller, who didn't care. FBI knew in January of 17 its collusion investigation was a bust, confirmed sealed dossier fabrication. So enter Jim Comey to engineer a special counsel to salvage the FBI's reputation by ginning up unrelated crimes. Mueller dredges up the Flynn interview, threatens to prosecute the NSA son unless he pleaded guilty to lying. And that's when Flynn initially pled out before he retrenched.
Why didn't President Trump pardon him earlier? That's one thing. You know, do you know why he waited until now?
I think you're waiting perhaps because when the Department of Justice stepped in and they dropped the charges against Flynn, you thought that would be the end of the matter. Then enter Judge Sullivan, and he steps in, and then he's rebuked by his own court, essentially, but they give him leave to get his act together as he continues with his fishing expedition where he's playing judge and prosecutor in the Flynn case. And then you have an election interceding in the meantime. He probably didn't want to make that an election issue, waiting till after the election or waiting until the collective justice system got its act together and ended the persecution of this guy. Well, it never did. So we're not going to get a Durham report. We're not going to get, it doesn't appear, much in the way of a reckoning for all of these bad actors at the upper echelons of FBI and other agencies. But at least Justice Flynn is going to get the justice, if you will, that he deserved to correct an injustice that he suffered. And it was interesting, too, because he penned this open letter. And it was really gracious, considering the political meat grinder he was put through.
This he's put through hell.
UncoverDC.com. Writes, never again should any family or individual be so viciously targeted, maligned, smeared, and threatened such has been the experience of my family and I. Not you or your loved ones, not me nor President Trump, our First Lady, the Trump children. Stand with me today in renouncing this betrayal of trust that has burdened our nation and proclaim with one united voice across this land we will never again allow the rightful power of the citizens of this country to be uprooted, undercut, usurped, or held hostage by a coup against our nation, a duly elected president, or any future president of these United States. He talks about his 3 decades in the service. He's thankful for the support he received from millions who communicated to him, supported him publicly. He obviously goes through his legal team, starting with Sidney Powell, and calls her an angel sent from heaven with the fighting spirit of David ready to slay Goliath. His sister, who I guess headed up his legal defense fund. He writes, time does not heal all wounds, but discovering the truth has a funny way of shaping the scars. To all Americans, what we choose to do in this life should never be stopped by fear. Instead, we need to embrace the uncertainty and accept the risk that comes with sacrifice and then work to overcome the sheer magnitude of life's challenges, especially during this crucible of our nation's history, our very survival as a nation is at stake. Flynn also gave his first interview since that pardon over the weekend. This to an outlet I've never heard before. World View Network or Worldview Network, I guess, is basically what it is. But Flynn talked about that coup that he referenced in his thank you letter, if you will. The coup that started 4 years ago and persists to this day.
I mean, I think what we experienced over the last 4 years, and certainly in the late 2016, very late 2016 and early 2017 period, was a very strong effort to unseat a duly elected president and really try to remove Donald Trump by just political pressure, by technology pressure, by financial pressure early on in his tenure, maybe to get him to just say, you know what, I don't need this. I'm not going to put up with it and walk away. I think that there was some sentiment. In fact, I know there was some sentiment to maybe he'll just, you know, he's the guy from New York. He's never not a politician. He'll just say, you know what, I don't need this stuff. I got better things to do and leave. And thank God that he didn't. And that then lasted. When he didn't, that then continued. That effort continued to go after him in any way possible to remove him through some means.
And it continues to this day. Here's phase two of the coup, according to Flynn.
This is still a coup in progress, but now it's a little bit different. And it's sort of they upped their game. When they lost in 2016, I think that there was a decision, and I believe this, but there was some type of decision to say, we're not going to allow this to happen again. I mean, all you got to do is go back and listen to some of the comments this past summer from some of the senior people that were, you know, that are part of this Democratic Party, right? I mean, Hillary Clinton won being, I think it was back in July or certainly mid-summer time frame where she said, no matter what, Joe Biden should not concede. What are we talking about there? I mean, why would she say that in the middle of the summer, 3, maybe 4 months before an election?
By the way, you can put General Flynn decidedly in the camp of President Trump won the election and he won in a landslide. He is a Trump loyalist on that score as well. Greg in LaGrange, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning, guys. How's everything?
Good.
This leaves a bad taste in my mouth. Of course, I'm happy for General Flynn and his family. They've been put through hell. It's all been a witch hunt. But the problem I have is that this is a systemic problem. It's still there. It's not gone away. Bill Barr has been an abject failure because he promised that we would know without doubt what happened prior to the election. We get nothing. We get nothing from Durham. As a matter of fact, I believe Peter Strzok is now sitting in some sort of position at Georgetown University. Can we strip the Catholic charter away from Georgetown University? They're nothing close to being a Catholic university. It's nobody goes to jail. And again, I'm very happy that he won, but he had friends in high places. For the average Joe like me, I look and I see nothing but corruption. I see nothing but politicization of those organs of our government that are supposed to defend all Americans, not just some based on their ideology.
Thanks for the call, Greg. You're right about Strzok. He's an adjunct professor at Georgetown University's Walsh School of Foreign Service. Isn't that nice?
Probably being celebrated.
It is remarkable. And the one other thing I'd say, too, about since Barr was brought up, the last thing that I believe we've heard from Barr is the letter he sent out shortly after the election to U.S. attorneys around the country suggesting that, it's legitimate to look into potential examples of election fraud. Not that that will change the outcome of the election. The standard is very high, but you should certainly be open-minded on the topic and then, a handful shot back at him that are political and so forth. But, we never really got any closure, if you will, on why Barr was unable to keep the commitment he made to the American people that they would know what happened in 2016 before the election. That didn't happen. We haven't really heard what the future, if there is one, of a Durham report is, where that investigation stands. We haven't heard from Barr at all. It would be interesting. I mean, Barr was certainly not shy about talking to the media in the run-up to November 3rd. It seems like there are some unresolved issues between now and potentially a new administration in January 20th that he needs to address. Kip in Stillman Valley, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, real quick. I can reflect everything and agree with what the last caller said. And I'm just wondering, if Barr doesn't do anything, can President Trump declassify everything that had happened, with the... I mean, it seems to me like Joe Biden's just going to bring back the ban. If they get away with what they've done in 2015 and that, can't they just keep just repeating process? This is amazing that they're getting away with it. Are we always supposed to sit back and have faith in our justice system? But if they can break the law, why can't I go out and break the law,
Thanks for the call, Kip. And it's a great point you raise, actually, about Trump declassifying information on his way out the door, if that's what indeed is going to come to pass. It's a great point, and you should absolutely do that. If, again, within his executive powers, provide as much justice, as much swamp drainage as he can, potentially on the way out the door. I think that's right.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and President Trump giving his first interview since the election to Maria Bartiromo on Fox Business yesterday. And this is what President Trump had to say, sort of reiterating his position on the election, which you heard him reiterate in some form or fashion throughout the weekend.
Is the DOJ investigating?
Missing in action. Can't tell you where they are. I ask, are they looking at it? Everyone says yes, they're looking at it. Look, where are they with Comey, McCabe, and all these other people? You know, I said I'll stay out of it. I wish I didn't make that statement. There's no reason really why I have to. But where are they with Comey, with McCabe, with Brennan, with all these people? They lied to Congress. They lied. They leaked. They spied in our campaign. I see Carter Page is bringing a lawsuit. That's good news. Where are they with all of this stuff? And, you know, what happened to Durham? Where's Durham?
You know, where is all that stuff, number one? And it's in the context of saying, why aren't they looking into what we believe was a rigged election? This is Trump during his Thanksgiving Day presser.
I mean, they have Biden beating Obama on Obama's vote in areas that mattered in terms of the election, in swing states. And yet he's losing to Obama all over the place. But he's beating Obama in swing states, which are the states that mattered for purposes of the election. So, no, I can't say that at all. I think it's a possibility. They're trying to look between you people. Don't answer. Don't talk to me that way. You're just a lightweight. Don't talk to me that way. I'm the president of the United States. Don't ever talk to the president that way.
And that lightweight was Jeff Mason, a Reuters reporter. Just to distinguish him from the other lightweights in the D.C. press corps. So that's sort of where Trump is at. Now, there was this moment going back to the holiday because you have two tracks now. You have the litigation in courts of law around the country, and you have state legislative hearings that have begun in some states where there is Republican control of the state legislature. Michigan is going to be this week. Pennsylvania senator organized a hearing on Wednesday before Thanksgiving, in which they took testimony from a number of individuals, including a retired Colonel Phil Waldron, former Army Information Officer, and Gregory Strensom, who is a Pennsylvania poll watcher. Let's do them in reverse order. Here's what Strensom observed and testified to at this hearing, is memorialized in an affidavit and filings in Pennsylvania courts. And then we'll get to retired Colonel Phil Waldron with the specific example that's quantifiable, but Strensen on what he witnessed as a poll watcher in Pennsylvania.
My name is Gregory Stenstrom. I'm from Delaware County. I'm a father, a family man. I was a former commanding officer and executive officer in the Navy. I'm a veteran of foreign wars. I'm the CEO of my own private company. I'm a data scientist. I'm a forensic computer scientist. I'm an expert in security and fraud. And we were told, I was told the next day the attorney that we had secured, that they said every election they leave a couple of USBs in the voting machines and they're brought back and generally the warehouse manager comes over and puts them in. So in talking to the U.S. Attorney General McSwain and other law enforcement officers, I found out that was not the case, that generally, more than two is unusual. So they denied they did it, but as of today, 47 USB V-cards are missing, and they're nowhere to be found. So I was told personally that these 24 to 30 cards that were uploaded weren't there. Those cards, I demanded that they didn't update the vote live time. They only updated it about once every 2 or 3 hours. I demanded they updated the vote so I could see what the result was, and it was 50,000 votes. And I think, as a computer scientist, an American, and a patriot, it doesn't matter who those 50,000 votes were. I'll tell you, they were for Vice President Biden. But what was shocking to me, as an American, as someone who has gone to sea, gone to war, that that could even happen.
And retired Colonel Phil Waldron, former Army Information Officer, calling for a forensic audit.
Our experts and other academics believe that up to 1.2 million Pennsylvania votes could have been altered or fraudulent. This is what we discovered in the last 22 days. Really, only a detailed forensic analysis of the actual machines and software will truly show how many Pennsylvania citizens have had their civil rights violated. So to use these type of machines with little or no audit trails, little or no transparency of how the votes are processed, where they go, where they're stored, will never leave the public satisfied that we truly have a representative democracy.
And then there was the gasp moment when he provided a specific example of these vote spikes that he mapped and what the distribution of those votes was in one instance.
So at the very beginning of the chart, where there's a circle that says on election day, what that indicates is there is a spike in loaded votes, 337,000 plus or minus of some votes that were added in there in one big batch. So that was an anomaly in the reporting. Normally you would expect to see a smooth curve going up, not any big spikes. That's kind of what Greg was talking about, the anomalies of loading and uploading those votes. So that big spike that occurs there is a prime indicator of fraudulent voting.
And that's 604,000 votes in 90 minutes, is that right?
Correct. This is 337 votes, 337,000 votes in that
period of time.
Yes.
And when you look at this entire curve with all these spikes, can you calculate how much of a vote that accounted for Biden and how much for Trump?
Close to 600,000. I think our figures were about 570,000 that all those spikes represent over time.
For Biden?
Correct.
And how much for Trump?
I think it was a little over 3,200.
How about that? 3,200 out of 600,000 votes. It's one of these statistical anomalies that we've discussed over the last couple of weeks that just continue to pop up without really any explanation, but also the problem with the Trump campaign, without any sort of substantiation that they're fraudulent. And this has been the frustration with the pursuit of the cases in courts of law, including in Pennsylvania. It just doesn't seem like the Trump campaign's lawsuits have zeroed in on the ballots, the batches of ballots, the cohorts that need to be zeroed in on to be reviewed so that specific claims could be made that perhaps would raise constitutional issues that could be addressed by the federal courts. And this is in part why he has seen a case dismissed both at the district and now the Third Circuit Court of Appeals level in Pennsylvania. And now they're appealing to the Supreme Court. But even that appeal to the Supreme Court, this is important to note, is very limited in scope. The appeal to the Third Circuit in Pennsylvania was not about curing ballots, was not, in some counties versus others, was not about accepting ballots after the election day deadline, the extension of that timeline by 3 days by judicial fiat. Those are equal protection issues that could be raised. It was on whether or not the Trump campaign should have been given leave to refile an amended complaint for the second time at the district court level. So if the Supreme Court were to take up that case, which I don't think they're going to, then the Trump campaign could only argue what they argued at the Third Circuit Court of Appeals level, which is that the judge at the district court level improperly denied them leave to refile an amended complaint a second time. That seems to me an indication that they don't have the specific numbers and the evidence to back up specific numbers of ballot cohorts that if the argument made on their behalf was agreed to by the court, there could be a remedy that would change the outcome in Pennsylvania. So the point is to say not that there's these not these wild statistical anomalies, because there are, and not that they all incredibly seem to redound to the benefit of Joe Biden, because they do. But the Trump campaign has a theory about what happened.
But they need to prove it.
Or they need to provide, you know, sort of contextual, circumstantial evidence, at least, to prove it in that sense, that clears, you know, a threshold for judicial consideration so that you can get to a discovery phase and you could ultimately potentially get to a remedy phase. They're not doing that. I don't know how else to describe it.
Well, they better get on it, because tick-tock goes the clock. But also in Wisconsin, too, they did do the recount. It was completed Sunday, and Biden gained 87 votes.
Yeah, but those recounts, the recounts in Dade and I mean, excuse me, in Dane and Milwaukee County are like the recount in Georgia. All they're doing is confirming the machine count.
Okay.
And so the issue is, by doing the hand recount, what did you discover? What did Trump campaign monitors discover such that they can provide specific affidavits to specific problems with things like in Wisconsin, the indefinitely confined cohort of ballots? There's like 238,000 ballots in a state that was decided by 20,000 votes. So here again, it would seem to me you come in and you say, number one, that the definition of indefinitely confined such that a voter ID requirement was skated around, that was wrong. And number two, from this hand recount we just did in Dane and Milwaukee counties, we've discovered this systemic problem of signatures not matching, or we've identified these number of ballots where the signature didn't match on these mail-in votes and so forth. And this is now specific things that you're litigating, both principle and the evidence to support the contention. That's where you go. And that's essentially what Trump said with respect to the suit they filed in Georgia on Wednesday after the second recount there, saying the same thing. It's not about the recount itself. The recount itself doesn't prove anything. You're looking for whether or not there were a bunch of ballots shoved through in the wee hours of Wednesday morning when the count stopped, as has been alleged, and as there was some evidence that was found in Dane County in Wisconsin. I saw Gateway Pundit reporting there were a couple of thousand fraudulent mail-in votes that were identified, all with the same signature, the exact same signature. So you have instances like that where you have evidence of fraud, and now you have sort of a discovery to try to you move to the discovery phase where you try to get your handle on the extent of the fraud and whether or not it could have a material impact on the outcome in that particular state if the sought remedy was to be provided by the court. That's where we're at. But I just – the Trump campaign has not done – they're on two tracks now with these state legislative hearings and obviously the cases in court. They just haven't done a good enough job zeroing in on and also communicating what they're zeroing in on to say, here's where we're at in Wisconsin. It's these 238,000 votes or whatever it is. Here's what we found through these recounts. And so here's where we're going to go back to a court of law to address. Same thing in Georgia. Same thing in Pennsylvania. I mean, do we still exactly know whether or not the ballots, absentee ballots, mail-in ballots collected after 8 p.m. on election night in Pennsylvania were segregated by election authorities the way they were supposed to be segregated, the way it was mandated they be segregated by Justice Alito?
And you hear numbers. There were 350,000, 600,000, or just 10,000 that came in after.
Did it happen? Were they segregated? How many? We don't know. How many ballots were cured in which counties, by county, and how many ballots could have been cured in counties that didn't allow curing as an option? Now you have specific cohorts of votes again, of ballots again, that you can argue over. You know, they have to get from like way out here to right in here to bring this in tight and make these specific claims, particularly those that raise constitutional issues, with specific, identifiable, tangible groups of votes. I don't know why this is so difficult. Marvin in Burlington, Wisconsin.
Yeah, the results of this election, I think is we're going to have to live with, but I don't think the American people as a society is going to accept it. Joe Biden is a completely illegitimate president, just like they claimed George Bush was. The whole Washington cabal was against Trump for the first term, and it's probably stand, but it's not going to sit well. And I believe it this manifests itself in the things that might not happen today, tomorrow, or 10 years from now, but maybe 20 years from now. And you're going to have, this is the same kind of thing that the French Revolution came about, because they have eroded confidence from the public, from the people who are supposedly supposed to be above reproach and are ethically in charge of, trying to make sure that society's run in a fair manner. And it has eroded our confidence completely.
Thanks for the call, Marvin. I mean, just to, again, bit specifics here. I mean, these are some of the numbers. This is Patrick Barsham pollster, some bit of a controversial pollster, but a pollster nonetheless, writing about some of these. He's over in London, Patrick Barsham, writing about some of these anomalies. So, for example, in Pennsylvania, 23,000 absentee ballots have impossible postal return dates, with another 86,000 have extraordinary return dates that they raise serious questions. In other words, impossible and serious. The question of backdating, the question of receipt after Election Day. Well, that's, 81,000 votes in Pennsylvania is the spread. That's 109,000 according to, Basham's interpretation. In addition to that, you heard from that poll watcher, Stenstrom, Delaware County, Pennsylvania, 50,000 votes held on 47 USB cards missing. In Georgia, Matt Brainard's Voter Integrity Project estimates that 20,312 people who no longer met residency requirements cast ballots in Georgia. Biden's margin of victory in Georgia is, under 13,000. In addition to all of the other anomalies about Biden overperforming only in metropolitan areas he needed to with respect to Obama, Biden underperforming union households as compared to Obama. Just sort of these remarkable things. He had these surges only where he needed them, and those surges receded like waves everywhere else in the country.
And then they stopped voting, too. And I've never seen
stop
that before.
Counting.
Start counting. Yeah, stop counting votes.
These specifics, so now we have these 20,000 in Georgia. Let's run through them. The 50,000 in Delaware County, Pennsylvania. The absentee ballots in Pennsylvania. The indefinitely confined in Wisconsin. Get specific and power through those defined groups of votes and voters, in the case of people who potentially no longer met residency requirements in Georgia, for example. The Trump campaign is just, it's not organized. It doesn't strike me as focused. It's not filing good complaints for the most part, the ones that I've read, and certainly the opinions in Pennsylvania at both the federal district court and appellate court level have been devastating. And by the way, the author of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals opinion was a Trump appointee. I mean, these are, Federal Society conservative judges, too, that we're talking about here. So it's not just, part of some conspiracy. There is also the quality of the legal representation that is being provided by Trump's legal team. That's a material issue, and it needs to be addressed. And they need to answer questions about why you can have op-ed writers and pollsters and radio talk show hosts have specific groups of votes or voters that should be focused in upon, and they can't do the same to get answers to these questions in states that are at bar. It's just perplexing to me. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app.
Just text the word APP to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and the curious case of this research that was posted at a Johns Hopkins University newsletter that was then taken down. This made the rounds over the weekend. Perhaps you saw it. I posted it with some comments on Parler, at Dan Proft on Parler, if you want to take a look. This is the work product of Genevieve Briand, Assistant Program Director of the Applied Economics Master's Degree Program at Johns Hopkins. She analyzed the effect of COVID-19 on U.S. deaths using data from CDC and providing a little bit of context over the last several years of looking at deaths. From mid-March to mid-September, U.S. total deaths have reached 1.7 million, of which 200,000 or 12% of the total deaths are COVID-related. She focused on total deaths per age group and per cause of death in the U.S. and then used this information to try to segment out the impact of COVID, excess deaths, which is a topic that has been much discussed over the last 9 months. You know, and the way you have to approach excess deaths is to look at them in comparison to total deaths. So she categorized them. Surprisingly, she found the deaths of older people stayed the same before and after COVID-19. Since COVID-19 mainly affects the elderly, experts expect an increase in the percentage of deaths in older groups. However, this is not seen from the CDC data. In fact, the percentages of deaths among all age groups remain relatively the same. Briand concluding, the reason we have a higher number of reported COVID-19 deaths among older individuals than younger individuals is simply because every day in the U.S., older individuals die in higher numbers than younger individuals.
Yeah, old people die. This just in.
Well, right, I mean, and it's not being dismissive of deaths in general or deaths of older people specifically. She's just trying to get a handle on what do we see actually happening here. And when she looked at the 2020 data during the seasonal period of the winter, where you see a rise in death by all causes, the top three being heart disease, respiratory influenza, and respiratory diseases, and then influenza and pneumonia, the differences become one of category. So what she found essentially can be summed up, is summed up when she said, instead of this expected drastic increase across all causes, there was a significant decrease in deaths due to heart disease. This sudden decline in deaths is observed for all other causes. The trend is completely contrary to the pattern observed in all previous years. Interestingly, the total decrease in deaths by other causes almost exactly equals the increase in deaths by COVID. This suggests that, according to Briand, that the COVID-19 death toll is misleading. Briand believes that deaths due to heart disease, respiratory diseases, influenza, and pneumonia may instead be recategorized as being due to COVID-19. So the point of this is not to minimize death or to minimize the virus. It's just to say, do we have a real handle on the lethality when you have deaths being recategorized away from one category of illness, respiratory diseases or heart diseases, and to COVID-19? Because if we're overestimating the lethality of the virus, even for older people, then are we not overshooting the response? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro/answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro/text line.
And we had a really dear friend of the show call me. She called on Wednesday right after the show and was crying because her sister has had congenital heart failure and was tested every day in the hospital because, you know, that's what they do in the hospital if you're in as a patient or even if you come to visit somebody. And she died from congenital heart failure, but they, excuse me, they put her down as a COVID-19 death. Her name's Grace, and Grace, I'm so sorry about the loss of your sister, but she was out of her mind. She's like, how dare they? Because some people still think that there's a correlation. If a hospital reports a COVID death, then they get some kind of federal funding and state kickbacks. And I'm going to ask, you know, Pritzker that today, but it's just to set it straight.
This research piece was taken down by Johns Hopkins. They didn't.
Yeah, they took it down. What did that say?
They didn't suggest that the underlying data was wrong. They just cited concern for misleading conclusions that could be inferred from the data. Well, okay, if the data is accurate and it's CDC data.
And the numbers don't lie, right?
If it's accurate, then if you're worried about conclusions, perhaps Ms. Breanne's conclusion being misleading, then offer some alternative explanations. This idea we're in this period where skepticism isn't allowed no matter how well-founded, no matter how substantial the evidence, if it runs counter to the ends that we desire, the policy ends that we desire. How is that science and research? How are these people, men and women of science and research, if you're going to dismiss research rather than address it? That's how science progresses, is somebody makes a claim, and that claim is peer-reviewed. Oh, the things are tested, you know, like vaccines. That's how we get from an idea about what could be a vaccine to an actual vaccine. An idea about how we should understand what's happening versus what a true understanding supported by the evidence looks like, sounds like. The idea that's just waved off, it's disallowed.
Because it doesn't fit their narrative. It doesn't fit what they've been pushing. It doesn't justify their draconian lockdowns and destroying people's lives. You know, we're sorry, but just to save one life, we're doing this because of science and data. And then the science and data comes up and death rates are exactly like they were last year. And we changed everything. We changed the way we teach our kids. We changed the way that we work, that we live. We wear these masks on our face.
It's
why?
It's interesting too. Facebook, I posted this on Facebook initially and
what happened?
And the article was flagged, and then the Facebook like warning label on it was, this image may contain partial nudity.
What?
Yeah, that's what it said.
Dan, what are you doing on your Facebook page?
I posted this Johns Hopkins research.
And they said it may contain nudity?
It's just bizarre. So then I just posted a graph and I posted a link to the research so people could find it that way. This idea that
scary stuff.
I mean, you know, so maybe there's something wrong with the methodology of Genevieve Briand, who's going for her master's in applied economics at Johns Hopkins. Nothing struck me. Nothing struck me unless the underlying data is corrupt, and CDC data, nobody's suggesting it's corrupt. So she raises some interesting issues to be discussed, and you can't just wave them off with people could draw the wrong conclusions. People can draw the wrong conclusions about anything. Address her conclusions. And then if you suggest there's some infirmity with her conclusion, then offer your own hypothesis or conclusion. But no, that's not how it works. How it works today is the media, as Holman Jenkins wrote over the weekend, we have a media that overwhelmingly sees its job as repeating things rather than finding things out and understanding them. That is a real problem in the press. It becomes an exponentially greater problem when people in the scientific community see their job the same way, that it's about repeating things rather than finding things out and understanding them.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 646-36, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Andy in Hinsdale, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. You know, there's a couple of things here, and one of them is, you know, we've had these doubts about this data ever since people like Dr. Ezekiel came out and said if you fell off a building and were tested positive, you would be listed as a COVID death. So that's one thing. But the second, the more alarming thing is this Facebook and Instagram censorship of data. I posted this on my Facebook, and I didn't get a nudity warning. I got a this is a false information warning. And, you know, this
– by the way, something Facebook is saying, but Johns Hopkins isn't saying.
Correct. And you know, and I got to tell you, I'm so tired of every post that Donald Trump puts up on Instagram gets a caveat underneath from Instagram saying – Joe Biden is the projected winner of the election. You know, I'm for myself and for people like of my age who are curious about this stuff, it's one thing. But you've got an entire generation of younger people who are not delving behind these numbers and not getting the true facts. And then they're getting it covered up when Facebook rules it that it's invalid information and it's not invalid.
Thanks for the call, Andy.
Yeah, he's getting flagged all the time on Twitter, too.
Yes, he is. Ed in Glen Ellen.
Yeah, I basically am saying the same thing that Andy did. I mean, when we found out early on that numbers were not going to be differentiated of dying with COVID or dying of COVID, there's no way you're going to get clear, accurate numbers. And that's what science needs. You know, when I tell people, well, why did the science change in 2020 when we've got decades of studies saying masks are effective if you're sick, but not if you're healthy. Suddenly in 2020, the science has suddenly changed. But yet when you have studies like this that have accurate science behind them, they get pulled down for fear of spreading misinformation or changing, as Amy said, changing the narrative.
Exactly. I mean, the CDC, no, don't forget this study, guys. 6% of all Americans who've died from COVID, just from COVID, only 6%. The rest, 94%, had a comorbidity. And that, you know, that doesn't sit well with a lot of Americans.
Yeah. No, again, to be fair on the other side, comorbidity, you know, there's tens of millions, perhaps in the hundreds of million Americans who have a comorbidity. So that's a general category, too. Everything from like a respiratory disease or to
hypertension,
yeah,
diabetes,
to being overweight. So, I mean, you know, we have 60% of Americans are overweight. So, I mean, you can't just dismiss people who are overweight and say, oh, I'm overweight. So what's the big deal?
No,
it's more specific than that. I mean, think about it this way. You know, we know that more than half the deaths occurred in long-term care facilities or nursing homes. And
your average lifespan once you enter a nursing home is 1 year.
Yeah, and again, nobody's trying to cut anybody's life short. That's the job of the left. That's the death with dignity crowd. That's not this crowd over here. But you're trying to say I just go back to it. I don't know. You have to go back to just reason over and over again, no matter how many different ways unreason comes at you. It's just to say, do we have a handle on the extent of the threat the virus poses? And is what we're doing the most effective, feasible thing that we can do, consistent with the idea that we live our lives by most likely scenario, not worst case scenario? If you can answer that question with a defense of these lockdowns, for example, okay, I'm happy to hear the answer. But if you can't, then that says something. And by the way, all of the other things that are under discussed, I mean, what we think we know and we don't know, what the experts pretend to know and they don't know, and this is why they have to do one of two things, either sort of reconstitute and reimagine their positions from an earlier time or just continue to make it bigger, double down on the policy that they chose at the outset because they need to defend the choice they made at the outset, lest they be accused of incompetence or worse.
Do you know how trapped we are in Illinois? Our kids can't go to school. Pritzker just took away the one joy that some of the kids had, and that was club sports. Can't do that. Business owners don't have jobs. Their busboys are out. I mean, people have to feed their families, Dan, and there's no science and data behind this screwiness.
How about this? In the New Woke Times, of all places.
The New Woke Times. I like that.
Two Columbia University eggheads. Quarantine may negatively affect kids' immune systems.
Oh, there you go.
It turns out that kids have immune systems. Did we know this?
Oh, do
we know? Listen to what Ms. Farber and Mr. Connors from Columbia University write in the New York Times. During the COVID-19 pandemic, the world is unwittingly conducting what amounts to the largest immunological experiment in history on our own children. We've been keeping children inside, relentlessly sanitizing their living spaces and their hands, largely isolating them. In doing so, we've prevented large numbers of them from becoming infected or transmitting the virus. But in the course of social distancing to mitigate the spread, we may also be unintentionally inhibiting the proper development of children's immune systems. Immunological memory and tolerance learned during childhood serve as the basis for immunity and health throughout adulthood. And they go through specific examples of sort of learned immunological responses. And that we may be, in addition to retarding children's intellectual growth, in addition to retarding their social growth, in addition to retarding their potential lifetime earning, now we're also making them more vulnerable to illness as they get older.
Did you know they closed a high school in Michigan? Not from COVID, but from strep throat. Because people didn't build up any antibodies and it just spread because kids had been separated from each other for 6 to 8 months. And then when we got back in the classroom, their immune systems were down. And also because strep survives on masks, by the way.
Listen to just more from this. Failing to train our immune systems properly can have serious consequences. When laboratory mice raised in nearly sterile conditions were housed together in the same cage with pet mice raised in standard conditions, some of the laboratory mice succumbed to pathogens that the pet mice were able to fight off. Additional studies of the microbiome, bacteria that normally inhabit our intestines and other sites, have shown that mice raised in germ-free conditions or in the presence of antibiotics had reduced and altered immune responses to many types of pathogens. These studies suggest that for establishing a healthy immune system, the more diverse and frequent the encounters with antigens, the better. Introduction of peanuts infants resulted in reduced incidence of peanut allergy, while avoidance had the opposite effect of promoting unwanted severe allergic immune responses to peanuts. Science. Jerry in Northwest Indiana.
My mother recently passed away, and they classified it as COVID. Now, leading up to that, she was in a nursing home. She had fell. She was on a, broke her hip, had been in there for over a year, mm-hmm. on a feeding tube. She had dementia. She had all kinds of pre-existing problems, and we were surprised she lasted as long as she did. And she was tested for COVID several times, and suddenly she was tested positive. And so they immediately put her all in the isolation, and they ended up putting her in the hospital because of the pneumonia. And she hung in there for almost 2 weeks. They never tested her again to see whether or not she still had the COVID. And that's the thing I'm really wondering, is if all this stuff, really, we are questioning the validity of the COVID designation on her death certificate. There's a lot going on out there.
Thanks, Jerry. Appreciate it.
You can always try and get the death certificate changed.
Chris and Carrie.
That's important to you.
Hey, Amy, can you please do us a favor when you speak to Governor Pritzker, whenever that is, ask him if he's going to constantly crow about the science and trot up the doctor who's going to talk about science. When the head of the CDC about a week and a half ago is saying kids need to be back at school, it's important that they be back at school, is that a science he's interested in, or is there another science that he's seen that the head of the CDC is talking about that's saying that school is important?
Okay, I can answer that question for you. This is what he's going to say. It's not up to me. It's up to the superintendents of each school district in the 11 different regions of the state to decide whether or not to go back to school. But that's not governing. That's governing from the fetal position. He needs to man up and act like Ronald Reagan during the, you know, the air traffic controller strike and say, get back to your jobs or you're going to lose your jobs. That's simple. And even Bill de Blasio didn't about face, and school's back in session for in-person learning in New York City, the death capital of the world. And if they can do it, why can't we do it?
Yeah, it's interesting. Just another point on this this open schools matter, because, right, there's general agreement that schools should be open among the scientific community.
Yeah, the left and the right, yeah.
And according to preliminary data, New York City schools have already lost about 31,000 students year over year, about 3.5% of their enrollment. And that does not include charter schools or early childhood programs. The analysis found bigger drops in enrollment at elementary and middle schools, losses in enrollment then versus high schools. Yeah. Losses in enrollment were more concentrated in schools serving mostly wealthy families. More concentrated in schools serving mostly wealthy families. So there again, the school shutdowns are, and for those supporting school shutdowns, they're essentially saying, I'm rich, I have options. The economic shutdowns, I'm rich, I have options. You don't, too bad, so sad.
Yeah, rich people got out. Same with in Chicago. Anybody who could afford private school or Catholic school got their kids out of CPS because they're never going back to school.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and we had this discussion of contemplating a hypothetical which absolutely needs to be gamed out. And the president has addressed it when he's been asked about it, too. But if you even raise the specter of Trump conceding the race and how that should go, what form it should take, then you're some kind of sellout. It's interesting. I get this email. I've been a loyal listener for many years, but after the concession talk this morning, this was Wednesday,
yeah,
I will not be listening anymore. The president should not concede after all the blatant cheating and stealing, and it is disgusting to hear you talk about this topic.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
The president can talk about it. We can't. It's absurd. I guess you won't be reading Victor Davis Hanson anymore either, and I'll get to him in a second. And then that was treated as
what?
Talking down to him. No, I'm talking level to you, and I'm talking level to anybody else. You have to live in the real world where contingencies need to be considered. And the president is doing that, and so is his legal team. They know the clock he's on. The president is asked about concession. He responds about it. He responds by saying that the election was rigged, and that's all well and good. He responds by the cases with explanations of the cases they're pursuing in court. He responds with the news of the day, but he also has responded intermittently with, if the Electoral College votes on December 14th, if he's got the votes, then he has the votes.
And if he doesn't have the votes, excuse me, then he said he will, there will be a peaceful transfer of power. And last night with Maria Bartiromo, yeah, he said this election isn't over.
We won the election easily. There's no way Joe Biden got 80 million votes. I just said there's no way Joe Biden beat Barack Obama in the black communities of various cities. And then he did very badly compared to Obama in other cities throughout the United States. There's no way it happened.
This
election was a fraud. It was a rigged election.
Well, Victor Davis Hanson, the path that is before President Trump, or the competing paths, he's got a couple. He writes, does VDH, what matters now are the interests of the country first and Trump's constituents second. So he's got a number of pathways. One, keep addressing legitimate reports of voter irregularities. Continue to ask the courts to set aside any illegal votes that do not conform to state laws. Yes, right. Absolutely. That's what he should do.
I agree.
But with Trump within days, we'll have to prove that any such crimes and lapses warp state counts enough to have wrongly elected Joe Biden president. Trump realistically has perhaps a week or so left to either make his case or concede. That's Victor Davis Hanson saying it now. Is he some sort of Trump betrayer as well? Or is he just 2 feet firmly planted on terra firma? Realistically, he has perhaps a week or left to either make his case or concede. Victor Davis Hanson. The guy who wrote the book, The Case for Trump. VDH goes on to say, and this is important, then to maintain the Senate majority for Republicans and to save the very rules and protocols of the Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Constitution, Trump will need to barnstorm Georgia. He has to enthuse his conservative base to reelect David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler, the two Republican senators there, to not just to protect, but first and foremost, the Supreme Court, the Constitution, the Senate, also much of what he accomplished in his first term, or in his term. Yeah. After that, VDH warns that his Make America Great Again agenda will be codified as his party's own. He has a year or more to decide whether he wishes to play kingmaker among would-be Republican congressional and presidential candidates or run himself for a second term, one term removed. Those two options are ultimately not mutually exclusive, but then, he's a year from now, VDH argues, by then you could have a lot of the country turned off by a hard left shift by the Biden administration as it's captured by the socialist Spice Girls in the House, the Jacobin left that runs the Democrat Socialist Party. Trump's other alternative is bleaker. Listen to VDH's characterization of the legal defense or the prosecution of Trump's legal rights to this point. Currently, Trump-affiliated lawyers claim they can prove their bombshell allegations of historic voting fraud by leftists and foreign interests. They further claim that Trump was robbed not of a close election, but of a veritable landslide, constituting the greatest scandal in U.S. history. But so far, none of these advocates have produced the requisite whistleblowers, computer data, or forensic evidence to prove their astounding charges. If they do not produce it in a few days, and if Trump pivots to put his fate in their hands, then the pilloried Republicans may well lose the Senate races in Georgia. And with that historic setback, he, Trump, would endanger his legacy, his influence, and perhaps a crack at a second presidential run. In blunter terms, Trump may be forced to choose within days whether he wishes to emulate Andrew Jackson, the aggrieved victim of the crooked bargain of 1824 that denied him victory in that year's presidential election, only to see Jackson storm back and win in 1828, fueled by a righteously aggrieved following, or be reduced to the status of sore loser like Al Gore or Hillary Clinton, and marginalized in the process.
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
And with respect to the legal cases, we went through them to some extent last hour, getting up to speed. And I've read some of the affidavits. I know the tech expert that Sidney Powell has on. I've read some of the affidavits in her court filings in Georgia and Michigan. But
what do you think?
But I don't think they're there. I don't think they're there yet. I don't think she has produced the goods to release the Kraken. Not yet. And they're on the clock. And that's reality.
That.
And that's reality. And that's what VDH is contemplating. And so if you want the movement, the Trump movement, to continue, if you don't want the movement as a whole to be cannibalized by the establishmentarians in both parties in the swamp, then you have to start confronting these choices that the president is going to be confronting in the very near term. And that's VDH's point. It's not to suggest that everything's hunky-dory. It's not to suggest these statistic anomalies should be ignored. It's not to suggest that there isn't a lot of smoke around the charge of election fraud. But you have theories, and then you have what you can prove in a court of law that rises to the level of constitutional issues to be adjudicated by a Supreme Court, for example, when you're talking about turning over states. The blocking and tackling of ballot challenges during a recount that gives you evidence to pursue more litigation in court, plus the constitutional issues that are triggered with decisions made at the state and at the state court level, like in Pennsylvania, combined with getting a handle on exactly how many ballots are implicated, how many votes are implicated, and what a potential remedy is that may change the result. And then there's just saying, I know it happened, I can't prove it, but you should turn it over anyway. And anybody who suggests anything short of that is some sort of Benedict Arnold or surrender monkey. I don't think so. No. And Trump has a lot at stake because of what he's accomplished and still can. And he should be preserving his interests at present, his interests and by extension the country's interests, at present as well as prospectively. That's the actual adult conversation. If you want to throw a temper tantrum, you're welcome to do that. I don't know what you think that gets you or the country. John in Villa Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys. In some ways, I totally echo what the guy's saying, because we kind of feel like, to concede this, the Democrats have us in the ultimate trick bag. If we scream like nuts, then we look like nuts. And it really sucks, and I don't think there really is any. I mean, the media has no backbone to do journalistic work to find out what happened, so the Democrats aren't going to do nothing. Nobody's going to play honest. But in my opinion, how do we ever come back from this if they found out the best way to win? To me, in the midterms, they'll just take the Senate then. They got their new recipe, and they'll just kind of run with it, and that's extremely my frustration. I'm kind of done with it all, too, but what can I do?
Yeah, I hear you. Thanks for the call, John. Although, old Mayor Daley stole it fair and square for JFK in 1960, one I think could persuasively argue, and that was at the end of the Republican Party. And in point of fact, the anomaly in this election, right, was of course the mail-in ballots.
Oh, yeah, because of COVID.
And
then the CDC on election day says, oh, even if you have COVID, you can go vote, just wear a mask and bring your own pen.
And perhaps some of those Republican-controlled state legislatures in swing states like Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin will learn some of the lessons from what happened on November 3rd, what happened this election cycle generally, and change their state election laws accordingly so it doesn't happen again. It is worth remembering, Florida was sort of a mess in 2000, sort of a national embarrassment, still has problems in places like Broward County. But over the last 20 years, from hanging chads to present, Florida has become a model for the administration of elections, particularly for a big, diverse state like Florida, like it is. So you can actually learn lessons from catastrophic outcomes in an election, perhaps even unfair, inaccurate outcomes in an election, and make necessary adjustments so they don't happen again.
And what, in Pennsylvania, the Secretary of State changing the rules, saying, things that are post-dated November 3rd will accept 3 days after.
Well, that was Pennsylvania Supreme Court.
Well, yeah, but you can't change the rules during the middle of a game. But they did, and it was wrong.
Well, right.
You want to live like that. You got to turn your homework assignment in on time. It's not as if they didn't know that this was coming.
But there are statutory remedies for all of this. And now, divided government, you have to fight it out potentially with Democrat governors in places like Michigan and Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, to use three examples. But perhaps not. Perhaps not. The point is that what happened this cycle isn't necessarily going to be the deal going forward. Now, the investigation should continue even past December 14th as new information becomes available. And here's what's going to happen. New information will become available after December 14th, after January 20th. What happened is so involved and requires such digging that, a few weeks is a very difficult timeline to pull it all together, I understand, which is why I've argued from the beginning that you should be focusing where you have your best chance and the areas where you have the easiest opportunities to pull together compelling information, evidence to get you past a motion to dismiss, to get you to discovery, to get you to the high court. The Trump campaign hasn't really done that, not with the level of focus I think it should have brought to the table. But we'll see. There's still time. There's still a couple of weeks, week maybe, but a couple of weeks generally, a week to make some progress and a couple of weeks for courts. But this will continue in the digital age. I mean, whatever happened, if what Sidney Powell is saying is true, that will come out in some form or fashion, or that will be a story that doesn't just evaporate. There will be more people once there is some removal from this that provide more evidence to support or to refute what has been claimed about foreign interference, about manipulation of vote tabulations by these vendors. It, because statements like Chris Krebs made last night on 60 Minutes will be remembered and perhaps challenged and perhaps proven to be inaccurate. Patrick on the Northwest Side.
Yeah, Dan, I got two questions I'd like to ask you. Pennsylvania is unique. They had a ruling by Judge Alito before the election that they had to segregate the ballots, and they disregarded Alito. I can't see that not winning in a Supreme Court. Even Alan Dershowitz says if that goes to the Supreme Court, I'm no fan of Dershowitz, said Trump's a winner on that one. And the other thing is, we know that Bernie got
on that.
Okay. And then we know that Bernie got, we all know, we're not Bernie supporters. We know he got cheated. So they will, if they cheat Bernie, what makes you think they're not going to cheat Trump? Thank you. Have a good morning.
Thanks for the call, Patrick. Jan in Hoffman Estates.
Yeah, this one is off topic, Dan, but I'm just wondering, why are the American flags at half mast at all the schools, municipalities, not at the post offices, but why have they been down for weeks?
Because Illinois has passed away.
No.
Thanks for the call, Jan.
It bothers me to death every time I see one. It's Pritzker, because he said, this is our 9/11, Amy. This is, you know, we've had 9,000 people die, and he's not going to raise it anytime soon. I said, well, when is it going to go back up? And he said, he'll decide, because this is a dictatorship.
Yeah.
We're the only state doing it, by the way, in the whole country.
Somebody who can't raise a flag won't raise a flag.
Yeah.
Tom in Blue Island.
Hey, Dan and Amy, good morning. Hope you had a good holiday. Dan got pounded a little bit on Twitter over the last few days over exactly what you're saying in reference to Victor David Hansen, who I have an incredible amount of respect for. I take some umbrage with the idea that Trump won't follow the regular protocol. When he exhausts his rightful legal options, he will concede. He will go to the inauguration and listen to knuckleheads fumble through, trying to be inaugurated president. But he doesn't have to accept it. I don't have to accept it. You and Amy don't have to accept it if we don't want to. But the idea that he isn't going to accede to the transfer of power and all that crap is just nonsense. But where I got hammered is the Georgia elections, because we're being preached to, and I understand the importance of the Georgia elections, we're being preached to by people who only supported Trump in a backhand way to save face or to not cause waves or to assure their power. Those people are telling Georgians and people from states like here, that we have to send money there to make sure the establishment stays in place. And I understand the importance of the elections and the Senate and everything. That's a hard pill to swallow, and it's going to be hard for them to force that down people's throats. But the idea that Trump won't go along with the transfer is little insulting, actually.
Well, who's saying that? I mean, the D.C. press corps?
They said that
you're referencing.
Dan, even just, and again, incredible respect for Victor David Hansen. When he's on any of his shows or I get a chance to read his stuff, I do. But it's the argument I'm kind of making is it's like he's advising Trump to do what he would do anyway.
Well, thanks for the call, Tom. I think he's just laying out the pass, and perhaps you're right. Perhaps it's more for Trump supporters than it is for Trump himself, because Trump, I'm sure, is contemplating the pass before him on an hourly basis as information changes, and he's getting whatever information changes a lot faster than we are.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it's more about messaging to supporters, VDH, than it is Trump himself. But it's important to sort of frame this out and think about it so we can have good conversations about it, too, in furtherance of what the best options are for the president and, by extension, the nation.
And I think that's what's going on. And the Daily Wire is reporting that Trump may announce his 2024 bid during the inauguration.
No, actually, the Daily Beast was reporting that, and the Daily Wire debunked that report.
They did?
The suggestion that this was a Daily Beast report that that was discounted by the Trump world.
Daily something.
So all this stuff is a swirl, and focus is important.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So before the Thanksgiving holiday, President Trump gave the family of General Michael Flynn something to be thankful for, that his 4-year-plus nightmare of malicious prosecution and malicious judicial intervention from the beginnings of the Russian collusion hoax to the end of the line for Michael Flynn with a pardon. Here's his attorney, Sidney Powell, reacting on Lou Dobbs.
If the justice system had worked properly, we would not have had to have gotten this pardon. But we certainly appreciate President Trump giving it to General Flynn, because this has gone on far too long. We now know that Judge Sullivan was just a political ploy. He's made a political game out of all of this. And it's just one of the most egregious injustices I've witnessed in American history.
For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by our friend Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Heritage Foundation, Vice President of the Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies. Colonel Jim, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, good to be with you.
The timing is understandable, but just on the substance of it, the merits, a long overdue intervention on behalf of General Flynn.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I know Mike forever. I mean, and military, since he's been out of military service as a cybersecurity expert, working with the campaign and serving the president. But honestly, I think just objectively, you've never met the guy, just objectively assessing what happened. And there was really no basis for prosecution. There was no basis to continue to hound him, and the judge's actions did seem kind of over the top. Now, that's not me as a lawyer. That's just me as an American citizen. And I think it's very, very difficult to look at this and not see how this is an appropriate and just outcome. I mean, he was essentially went after for nothing. I mean, he did not do anything to jeopardize the national security of the United States. He never intended to mislead the FBI, and so it does seem like just a massive miscarriage of justice.
With respect to the FBI, President Trump wondered aloud this weekend with Maria Bartiromo, where is the FBI? What happened to the Durham investigation? Has anybody seen Attorney General Barr? He was asking in the context of the legal challenges to the election results, number one, but more generally, it was really a open question, rhetorical one, perhaps, in terms of the lack of a reckoning for some of the actions taken by some of the actors over the last 4 years in the Department of Justice and elsewhere. It seems like this is an important blow for justice for Michael Flynn's family, but sort of a small blow in the grand scheme of things for the American people.
Yeah, well, the one thing we know is that people that were directly connected with the oversight of the Flynn investigation, nobody got any credit for that. There was internal IG investigations. Some of them were censured. Some of them were relieved from their duty. Some of them were fired. So nobody covered themselves in glory. And look, people, including the senior leadership, only escaped further retribution because nobody committed. They actually committed a crime. They could just prove that they were incredibly incompetent and unthoughtful in the way they led the investigation. So, you know,
yeah, but you know, when you have Peter Strzok, when you have Peter Strzok have a nice soft landing over as an adjunct professor at Georgetown, it sort of speaks to this above the law cabal culture inside D.C. and in particular institutions, big government, big academia, big cultural important people.
Well, I mean, I think that's different from holding people legally accountable under the law.
Understand.
I mean, we have created an incredibly poisonous partisan environment here that essentially decides right and wrong, good and bad, is who aligns with me politically. And I think, you know, the Straw case is an incredible example of that. In old Washington, he would have been an outcast. I mean, he was incompetent in the way he led the investigation. He was highly political, highly inappropriate, highly unprofessional. He embarrassed one of the most important law enforcement organizations on the face of the planet. And he got rewarded for it simply because he was a political enemy of the president.
Yeah. On another matter, was this Israel trying to pin in Joe Biden a little bit, a potential Biden administration, from getting too cozy with Iran? Yet again, I'm talking about the killing of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who is the top nuclear scientist for Iran's nuclear program, over the weekend. Wall Street Journal characterizing, at least one analyst characterizing it as another bold strike against Iran from Israel. And, you know, certainly if they want to send John Kerry over there with James Taylor to do a sing-along for the Ayatollah, then that's all well and good. But the Israelis very concerned, perhaps, with what a Biden administration might mean for stability in the Middle East.
Well, I mean, this is a really high-profile incident. I mean, here you had one of Iran's chief nuclear scientists taken out, so that obviously raises a lot of questions. But what's interesting is, in conjunction with that, during the same time, you had a number of Israeli strikes on Iranian positions in Syria. So clearly, the Israelis are trying to do as much catch-up as they can before the end of the administration, because they don't know what they're going to get from the next administration. So they're trying to start off in as strong a position as possible. And, you know, quite honestly, the Biden team during the campaign and they continue to kind of really send incredibly unclear signals here. I mean, they say, well, we're going back to the Iran deal, which, you know, it sounds simple on the campaign trail, but in practical effect, it's almost impossible to do. But what are you going to do about the Iranian cheating? Do you really want to lift the arms embargo? Do you really want to essentially marginalize all the countries that just normalize relations with Israel? They haven't talked at all about the normalization process other than just, you know, saying, well, it's nice that they're normalizing. They've given no indication about the peace process. There's a lot of people in the party that have become incredibly anti-Israeli, anti-Zionist, I mean, anti-Semitic in some ways. The party's all over the place. So if you're in the Middle East, I mean, you have to look at this, at what's going on here, and say, well, what if there was a Biden administration, what the heck would we actually expect from that? And the Israelis are very proactive in their security interests, so it wouldn't be surprising if they were taking measures to start off in as strong a position as possible.
Hey, Lieutenant Colonel, did the U.S. play any part in this assassination?
I have no idea. I mean, all I have is what other people have is the information that's publicly available. And, you know, to be honest, a lot of it's, you're just speculating. I don't know what's appropriate for that.
With respect to Israeli and their position in the Middle East, so as you're talking about the mixed signals the potential Biden administration is sending and where Israel wants to be, what about where Saudi Arabia wants to be and how what you are describing factors into this meeting that did or did not happen between Bibi and MBS?
Well, I think that, you know, the expectation was that the countries that were planning to normalize were going to accelerate the normalization process. And I still think the Saudis are really interested in that. You know, the problem is if you look at, you know, the Biden team and how they've talked about countries in the region in the past, you know, they don't want to do business with Saudi Arabia. They don't want to do business with Turkey. They don't want to do business with Egypt. They don't want to do business with Israel, which is fascinating because those are all the major powers in the region. And it'd be literally impossible to have a foreign policy without that. Conversely, you see those countries, particularly the Saudis, the Israelis, and the Egyptians saying, you know what? There's strength in numbers. And the tighter we are together, the stronger leverage we have in the region and with the United States.
So what is the sense of this foreign policy team, such as it's been introduced, including Anthony Blinken, but also including John Kerry as a former Secretary of State, even though he's got some sort of honorific czar title this go around? What is their posture going to be, do you think?
You know, I the famous Einstein quote just keeps rolling around in my head. You know, the guy that, you know, keeps doing the same thing. And the definition of idiocy is keep doing the same thing and thinking you're going to get a different outcome. So essentially you have a replay of Obama people. So why would we expect, you know, different or better outcomes? I mean, I think a Biden team would start with an enormous amount of skepticism that you're bringing back all the people that produced really 8 terrible years of foreign policy. And you expect us to think they're going to do better. And when you actually look at, in the campaign, what Biden put on the table, he said, well, we're going to have a different tone, which is, you know, magical. If, you know, if a different tone could solve things, you think people would have done that a long time ago. So that's kind of meaningless. They're going to sign a bunch of agreements which aren't helpful to the United States, like the Paris Accord. And they're talking about going back to JCPOA, which was one of the most, the greatest failed policies of the 21st century. So it's just not a lot of cause for optimism there.
Well, the timing's perfect since Boko Haram massacred 110 civilians in Nigeria. He can bring back Michelle Obama's Bob Dylan cue card campaign with bring our girls back, or hey, Boko Haram, stop being terrorists, or something like this.
Well, yeah. So, you know, we actually go into the new year and the U.S. is really one of the strongest foreign policy positions we've had in a long time because we actually had very, very good foreign policy the last 4 years. So there's a question, do you want to upset that? There are emerging areas of concern that the U.S. has to pay more attention to. Latin America is one of them because of Chinese influence. Africa is one of them because of Chinese influence, but also because, as you mentioned, if there is a concern about kind of a resurgence of Islamist transnational terrorism and influence in the world, it is kind of in Africa. So there is an important CT concern, and there's an even more important concern about Chinese economic and political influence.
He is Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, author of Wiki at War and Private Sector Public Wars. Jim, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And Joe Biden at another one of these sort of pro forma unity pressers he had on the occasion of the Thanksgiving holiday had this to say about religion. Seem to have lost our audio page here. Okay. All right. Well, we'll try to get that back.
And if we do, and I'm sure we can proclaim the palmist who wrote
these following words. The Lord is my strength and my shield.
Yeah, two Corinthians and a palmist walk into a bar. The difference between Donald Trump's gaffe with two Corinthians and Joe Biden's gaffe with palmist rather than psalmist, as in writer of psalms.
I even knew that, Dan, so that's pretty bad.
The difference is that President Trump never wore his religion on his sleeve. He wasn't running around saying, I'm a devout Catholic, not wrapping himself in God, as well as sort of using God as a cudgel to say, oh, these people don't care about the lives of others if you don't support our secular lockdown policies. I suppose that's the difference. You're a... you know, it's unchristian. It's almost John Kasich-like. It's unchristian if you don't support Obamacare Medicaid expansion. That's the way they invoke. They invoke God to defend big government gambits. And it's inauthentic. Like everything else about Joe Biden. Joe Biden the fabulist. Joe Biden who lied about his academic record. Joe Biden the plagiarist. Joe Biden and his apocryphal stories about growing up.
With corn pop.
Everything is a put on with this guy. He's a fraud. There is just cant where a brain once sat. That's Joe Biden. Like most of these cookie, cardboard cutout, one-dimensional human beings walking around in suits in D.C. You know, the proverbial politician Earl Scheibed into looking somewhat consequential, to borrow a Dennis Millerism. That's Joe Biden. An inconsequential man, Earl Scheibed into looking somewhat consequential, who Chauncey Gardner's, if he gets there, Chauncey Gardner's his way to the White House. Fabulist.
And if people don't think that it's kind of a communist country with Joe Biden when it comes to the media, to ask a question, you have to submit it in writing first. And then they decide which reporters' questions they're going to take. And also yesterday, or on Saturday, when he had to go to the hospital, they wouldn't let any media that's been following him get pictures of him going in or going out after he fell down because of his dog. He was playing with his dog Major, and he twisted his ankle and has a hairline fracture. So, I mean, that's what might be coming down the pipe.
Well, of course.
That kind of democracy.
Yeah, you're right. It's a big government state press corps. That's exactly what it is. But when they're not regurgitating Biden press releases or running cover for him, they're publishing these wonderful think pieces. The Daily Beast, this is supposed to be a serious left outlet.
Okay.
Lengthy story, an interview with Beth Lee Crowther. She's a pet psychic.
Oh, I love pet psychics.
They're
the best kind of psychics.
She claimed to have communicated telepathically with Joe Biden's two pet dogs. She says that...
the one that tripped him, Major?
I don't know. Perhaps. Perhaps there's some sort of, some assassination attempt. Yeah. Mind control of the dogs here with the pet psychic.
Old people fall, by the way.
Her mind-to-mind communication with Biden's two dog occurred on a British television show when she was presented with a picture of them. She said the two dogs proceeded to give her insight into Biden as a person and how he would govern the country as president. The very first thing I got was that they were both very excited about moving to the White House, said the pet psychic to the Daily Beast. I had a real connection. I felt that excitement of theirs. They showed me that Joe Biden is very bonded to his dogs and has a real connection to them. They kept showing me that although he has rescued one of the dogs feel in many ways like they've rescued him. Oh, it's a wonderful, dog owner relationship, but rooted in equality, of course. Mm-hmm. Biden's dogs also conveyed that Biden has big personality and he has great empathy for people and animals. The pet psychic also claimed Biden can't function without dogs in his life. He talks to them like they are people about his ideas and hopes for the future. I assume he probably gets a lot of ideas from his dogs as well, since they have this wonderful symbiotic relationship, as so documented by the pet psychic, who was featured in a nice Daily Beast spread. There's your DC press corps in the Biden era.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Well, we've mentioned it, but we haven't gotten to it, so let's get to a little bit of what Chris Krebs had to say on 60 Minutes last night. He is the former head of the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA.
Yes, I love CISA.
Which, among other things, has election security under its charge. He was fired after the election by President Trump after sort of openly disputing President Trump's claim that fraud had occurred in the election. This is what Krebs had to say sort of as a general statement about the 2020 election.
I have confidence in the security of this election because I know the work that we've done for 4 years in support of our state and local partners. I know the work that the intelligence community has done, that the Department of Defense has done, that the FBI has done, that my team has done. I know that these systems are more secure. I know, based on what we have seen, that any attacks on the election were not successful.
He called the idea that systems were hacked, the claims made mainly by Sidney Powell, most specifically and brashly.
That there is some hacking of these election vendors in their software and their systems across the country. It's nonsense.
Just nonsense, he said. Krebs also said that the fail-safe with respect to ensuring that the election was secure, paper ballots
give you the ability to audit, to go back and check the tape and make sure that you got the count right. And that's really one of the keys to success for a secure 2020 election. 95% of the ballots cast in the 2020 election had a paper record associated with it. Compared to 2016, about 82%.
And with a paper record, you can go back and verify what the machine is saying by physically counting the paper.
That gives you the ability to prove that there was no malicious algorithm or hacked software that adjusted the tally of the vote.
I mean, did he seem believable to you?
Because he seemed a little angry because he couldn't say goodbye to his staff. I mean, I don't know if...
Well, he's potentially believable, but what he said does not preclude the possibility of fraud, including fraud that would involve the vendors of the voting systems, the hardware as well as the software. So, for example, hypothetically, I don't know this, but just saying it's possible, the open question as to the vote counting stopping in the wee hours of the Wednesday morning following the Tuesday election, so November 4th morning. Is it possible that they had a real-time handle on what the vote totals were? You know, in big states with big metropolitan areas, sort of what you need to come out of Milwaukee County with, what you need to come out of Philadelphia with in order to win Wisconsin and Pennsylvania,
Detroit
respectively.
For Michigan. Yeah.
Same. You know, generally speaking, so. If you know what you need to come out with and you're not there, then you could have a bunch of phonied up ballots that are processed through the machines, that are recorded by the machines accurately, that are recorded and recounted accurately in a recount like happened in Dane and Milwaukee counties most recently, and say, well, look, the counts match, no fraud, no hacking. Well, it's a combination of high tech and low tech. I'm not saying it happened. I'm saying it's possible. So what Krebs said yesterday, and of course Scott Pelley doing the interview for 60 Minutes, is completely
got his glasses off, his pen, his finger on his cheek. He's really concerned.
Well, but there's no follow up questions. There's no thinking going on there. They're just prompting for the answers they want. This election was secure. Americans should have 100% confidence in it. End of story. Period. That's a wrap. Right. Cut tape. And so. But I mean, there are other scenarios not contemplated by Krebs in which voter fraud could have occurred, and this is why these things are litigated, and this is why you do a recount, and then you're able to actually watch the count and to look at the ballots and to do signature checks and then you start to record more evidence of irregularities that could then be later introduced as evidence in a complaint to pursue legal remedies. That's what's actually in process. I know 60 Minutes want that to be like the definitive statement on the campaign, that interview, but it's not. Even if you take everything Krebs said as accurate. For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined by We're pleased to be joined
by
Alan Bakari, who's a senior technology correspondent at Breitbart News. He's also the author of, I wanted to make sure I had the book right, Deleted, hashtag Deleted, Big Tech's Battle to Erase the Trump Movement and Steal the Election. Alan, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hi, great to be on.
So why don't we start with what Chris Krebs had to say yesterday in that 60 Minutes interview, and what your handle on it was in terms of this idea that, look, you have these election, cyber election experts and other people saying there's no evidence of, yes, there's perhaps even maybe conceding, yes, there are these statistical anomalies, but there's no evidence of massive fraud, whether of a high-tech or low-tech nature. And so the election was legitimate. The American people should have 100% confidence in it. And it's time to inaugurate Joe Biden.
Well, I mean, you know, Chris would say that, given that it was his job to ensure election integrity, but he's not in a position to do that. He hasn't investigated all of these suspicious incidents in the election. He doesn't know what went on in every precinct, and he doesn't seem to like Trump very much. He's been another one of these, you know, anti-Trump people who were embedded in the bureaucracy. And, you know, just came out at the right moment to challenge the president's view on things. I also want to talk about a bit about the mainstream media. It's really fascinating. If you go through the last 4 years of coverage since the 2016 election, you'll find endless stuff about hacked voting machines and potential fraud and potential hacking of the 2016 election. Of course, all of that, including, by the way, about the Smartmatic machines. There were lots of media coverage about that and how vulnerable they are. Of course, that's now abruptly stopped in the wake of the 2020 election night. So, it's not at all surprising to see that change in coverage.
Well, could there have been foreign interference in this 2020 election?
It's impossible to say. I mean, I've never thought much about the whole idea of foreign interference on social media platforms. This is one of the things I talk about in my book. That was sort of the panic whipped up by the mainstream media after 2016. The truth of the matter is foreign interference on social media platforms in 2016 was a few Russian memes on Facebook that didn't really influence everyone, and even left-wing academics and researchers who looked into it found, well, this was highly unlikely to influence anyone because it targeted strictly partisans on both sides, so not people who would, you know, have their minds changed easily. I think the real thing that needs to be talked about more is the interference of Silicon Valley companies, because I think that actually had a huge impact the way, and this is what Deleted, the book, is about. I think that had a huge impact on the kind of information that undecided voters especially saw, and they're the really crucial voters because they're the ones whose mind is not necessarily made up. So if they go onto Google and they search for, say, Joe Biden, all they see is a bunch of propaganda, that's going to have a huge impact on them.
Well, this is exactly what Bob Epstein, the Harvard-trained psychologist, has argued for years now, testifying before Senate subcommittee back in July of 2019, and he was out again last week talking about the research that he did, he and his team, which is pretty substantial, continuing 7 years of research in terms of Google's impact. And this is somebody who was a Hillary Clinton supporter in 2016, Joe Biden supporter in 2020. He's a liberal. He argued, I believe, that Google changed at minimum. He doesn't have the upper register yet, but at minimum, Google moved 6 million votes. And obviously that is millions more votes than decided the election over the spread of a few states. But through manipulating search algorithms, they moved at least 6 million votes, according to Bob Epstein.
That is a highly plausible number, I think. And the reason it's plausible is because of the level of information that all of these companies have on each and every person using their services. They know exactly who the undecided voters are. They know exactly what issues each one is interested in. And, you know, they already provide, these companies already provide tailored content to everyone based on their interests in order to, you know, sell us products, get us to click on ads. So when you imagine them doing the same with regards to politics, you can kind of understand the level of influence they can have and why it goes so far beyond, say, you know, bias in the mainstream media, where we're sort of aware of what's going on, we're sort of aware of the partisan biases of news hosts, but we're not aware of it when it comes to these Silicon Valley algorithms that are all hidden from view.
Yeah, and you know, consistent with that here, again, just in terms of media influence, you talk about it, but is there a way to quantify it? Well, Bob Epstein is quantifying Google's manipulations. Also, Brent Bozell's group, the Media Research Center, commissioned a survey of 1,700 people who voted for Biden in seven swing states. And they found that they gave like awareness of eight different stories, found that 82% of people who voted for Biden did not know of at least one of the eight stories, and that 35% of people who voted for Biden, for example, did not know the allegations from Tara Reid, who said that Biden sexually assaulted her. One in three did not. And then you go on to the jobs numbers from June to October. They didn't have an appreciation for that and so forth. And, you know, if they would have known, had awareness of these stories, if those stories would have been covered, generally speaking, the way they would be covered if they were good news for, say, a Joe Biden, that would have changed enough of those surveyed votes to have swung the election to Trump, even setting aside all of the allegations of fraud and misconduct.
And that's believable to me, too, that so few people knew about those stories. We've done multiple news stories of Breitbart News showing how Google actually took clicks and impressions to Breitbart News. They took them to zero in midsummer after a major algorithm change on searches for Joe Biden. So up until that search algorithm change, you know, if you search for Joe Biden on Google, you'd get a few Breitbart links, and there was, you know, a normal pattern of activity of clicks and impressions to those links. But then the change comes in, and all those clicks and impressions dropped to zero. So we were completely wiped out on searches about Joe Biden, and it remained that way until election night.
Well, then how can you fight back? I mean, Breitbart News as an organization, what can you do?
I mean, that's a great question. I think these companies really need to be regulated. They have far too much influence over the course of Democratic politics. So they get to pick and choose winners in the news media. And it's not just in America, but in every market where these companies dominate. We're in this crazy situation now where a handful of extremely woke, extremely left-wing companies in Silicon Valley are now influencing politics all around the world. It's no surprise to me, seeing a news report earlier today, that Boris Johnson in the UK wants to look at the censorship question now because he was concerned by what he saw these companies were doing in the American election.
Well, and you wrote about this too, what Facebook did after, just so we can loop Facebook in here as well, Facebook did after the election. So they drive you through sort of what you see and what you don't see to a decision. They try and drive as many people to a decision. And then they try and drive you to an understanding of the implications of the decision you made. So they drive you to vote for Biden. And then after the election, they suppress Breitbart and promote CNN to essentially discount any suggestions that may be circulating that there was anything untoward about how the election was conducted.
Yes, it's called a news ecosystem. They call it the news ecosystem quality ranking. And this was fascinating to me to see this. I believe it was the New York Times that reported on the existence of this thing, because this is one of the things that my sources told me about in the book, in Deleted. There were a number of interviews with Silicon Valley whistleblowers inside these big companies. And he told me that every single one of these companies has this score that they can use to turn down the volume on certain types of content, to push it further down people's feeds, push it further down search results. And that sounds like, you know, a conspiracy theory that, you know, Silicon Valley has this secret, you know, Chinese-style social credit system where they adjust the rankings of people based on what they like and dislike. But now the New York Times comes out and confirms it. So So all of the things that sound like conspiracy theories about what Silicon Valley is doing, you know, they're all turning out to be true.
He is Alan Bakari, senior technology correspondent at Breitbart, author of Deleted, hashtag deleted, Big Tech's Battle to Erase the Trump Movement and Steal the Election. Alan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. Good luck with the book.
Thank you. Great to be on.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And Moderna moving to seek emergency use authorization from the FDA for their vaccine. Pfizer and BioNTech expected to get regulatory approval across the pond in the UK, such that NHS hospitals are on notice to be prepared to receive and begin distributing dosages of their vaccine by Wednesday. Of this week.
Wow.
So, speaking of which, and then where is Pfizer BioNTech with the FDA? What's the holdup here? That's one of many questions. The other is one of whether or not the prologue to death holiday dirges from certain TV epidemiologists will continue to be the norm into Christmas. And if Tony Fauci is any indication, they will be.
Can't see how we're not going to have the same thing, because when you have the kind of inflection that we have, it doesn't all of a sudden turn around like that. So clearly, and we're going to have the same sort of thing, and perhaps even 2 or 3 weeks down the line, Martha, we may see a surge upon a surge. You know, we don't want to frighten people,
surge.
But that's just the reality. We said that these things would happen as we got into the cold weather and as we began traveling, and they've happened. It's going to happen again. So I cannot see all of a sudden a relaxation of the kinds of recommendations or restrictions, because we're getting into colder weather and in a even larger holiday season as people travel to come back and forth for Christmas. So I don't see a relaxation of the kind of recommendations and restrictions that we've made.
Yeah, well, you're seeing an increasing resistance there, Dr. Fauci. And when you lose the French... Thousands of Parisians out in force over the weekend chanting liberté, because at least some recognize you can have no égalité or fraternité without liberté.
Nicely done.
Thank you very much.
Nice.
Also protests in London, in New York City.
New York City?
New York City. Staten Island Pub has declared itself an autonomous zone.
That's awesome.
If it's good enough for the center of Seattle, you know, I love when you hoist the left by their own petard, so to speak.
What's their name?
Max Public House in Grand City. Has declared themselves an autonomous zone. The liquor license has been suspended. They don't care. They're serving liquor anyway, and they're just taking donations. So you don't actually have to pay for the liquor. Uh-huh. This is like the episode of Cheers where Rebecca forgot to renew the liquor license, and so they just gave away drinks so they weren't in violation of the law. It's getting a little silly, but underlying some of the silliness is real seriousness, which is people's lives and livelihoods are on the line.
Yeah, I remember the motto, you know, a virtual Thanksgiving means you won't have an ICU Christmas.
Yeah, right. Hallmark for the misanthrope sort of messaging. I get it. But some people have had enough of taking it. And, this is going to continue to get increasingly tense, even ironically, as I said at the outset, with the distribution of one or more of the vaccines in the offing. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined again by Dr. Roger Klein, expert with the Regulatory Transparency Project's FDA and Health Working Group, former director of molecular oncology at the Cleveland Clinic, former advisor to the FDA, CDC, CMS, and HHS as well. Dr. Klein, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Yeah, hi, Dan. Hi, Amy.
Hello. So let's start with vaccines. So Pfizer, BioNTech, they're going to be good to go this week in the UK, it is reported. Moderna seeking emergency use authorization here. Where is the FDA in processing Moderna, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, and getting those vaccines on the street in America?
It's right there. You know, I think they'll move relatively quickly. You know, under the current administration, I think they'll continue to encourage them to, for example, work through the weekend. And you know, I expect we're going to have these vaccines within the next few weeks here. You know, they do have to go through data, and we make light of it, but I mean they actually we do want to make sure that we fully understand these vaccines. They appear to be effective, at least in some measure, and maybe extraordinarily effective, but we want to make sure that they don't do harm as well. So I think, you know, I expect that FDA is going to turn them out. I saw a report that supposedly some of the Pfizer vaccines are in Chicago already.
Airlines is getting ready to ship them. But yeah, I'm looking for that right now. That was news yesterday, and I can't find it today. But I know that United Airlines is ready to help out.
Well, it's great news, you know. And it's going to be a while to get it to the general population. Of course, a lot of people probably won't choose to take it anyway. But I think, you know, to getting it out to healthcare workers, getting out to vulnerable populations, that'll happen within the next few weeks to months. And I think we'll do much to at least reduce the mortality from the disease, which is, I think, what we're really going for.
Yeah, speaking of mortality, were you aware of this controversy that bubbled up over the weekend about this research coming out of Johns Hopkins, a student in the Applied Economics Master's Program at Johns Hopkins, who looked at some of the mortality data from CDC? And essentially her conclusion was what we see compared to, you know, historically this time of year and then on an annualized basis is not necessarily excess death with respect to COVID, but rather deaths from other causes being recategorized as COVID deaths, deaths from respiratory illness, deaths from heart disease being recategorized as COVID. And, I don't see there was any particular political agenda about it. She's just sort of crunching numbers as an economics project or econometric project. And yet Johns Hopkins took this research down, suggesting that not that the data was inaccurate, but that it could lead to misleading conclusions, although they offered no alternative conclusions from the data. And it just speaks to sort of the larger issue of research that you don't like, the implications of research you don't like, you just eliminate the research if there's the right political pressure.
Yeah, I think that's right. So I heard this, and I didn't look into it in great detail, but others have reported that excess mortality, and particularly in the older age groups, isn't what one might expect from hearing news reports about COVID-19, and does support the idea, along with other CDC reported data, that most folks have comorbidities. And so, so a lot of the people who have died probably would have died anyway within a year. I hate that. You know, I'm not trying to be callous about it, but I think that there's a lot we have to learn. But, you know, when something strikes elderly people, and people who are really old are the ones most at risk, those folks don't have a long lifespan ahead of them anyway. So I don't... It's not hard to understand that. And I agree with you. You know, look, science and medicine is not immune to political influences the same way everybody else is. And you know, I was reading Cheryl Atkinson's book. I've started her book, her new book this weekend, and about Slanted, it's called. And
yeah.
It's really
we had her on last week.
Yeah, it's a great book for somebody like me, you know, to come in and the idea that these narratives don't influence science and medicine, I think, is that would be misplaced. You know, we try to be objective, but we're not outside society. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and Doctor, you're correct. United Airlines has begun shipping first batches of the vaccine to their hubs, and they're just waiting for the FDA's approval. Why does the FDA seem to be dragging their feet on this?
Yes, I mean, they have a, I mean, you could call it dragging their feet. You know, usually they would take months. So I you know, I'm not sure if they're dragging their feet. I think they need to thoroughly review the data. I don't think they can simply, I know they can't simply just rubber stamp something that's sent to them. So, I think we have to give them a few weeks to look at it. I don't think it's reasonable to expect people not to do their work. And hopefully they're getting enough pressure to put in the hours to make sure that they do the job properly, but efficiently and effectively and rapidly.
And by the way, I wouldn't go around telling other of your colleagues that you're reading Cheryl Atkinson's book Slanted if you want to be invited to Tony Fauci's Zoom happy hour. Some political. You give the medical advice, I'll give the political advice. So what about Tony Fauci? I know he is still the oracle of infectious diseases in the West, but the statements you heard at the top about, you know, Christmas is going to be like Thanksgiving, is going to be like next Thanksgiving, is going to be like next Christmas. It's not just doom and gloom. I mean, to some extent, he's the boy who cried wolf, isn't he? I mean, yes, there were predictions about there could be a second wave in the winter. Right. A lot of predictions about that. So then what we did in the run up to that second wave was ineffectual, or we shouldn't have stopped the total lockdowns we were in the spring, or what is it exactly? They're sort of predicting things after the fact and pretending like they saw it all along.
Yeah, look, we've known all along this is a contagious respiratory virus. Most people who have it don't know they have it. So, of course, it spreads pretty readily, and once people spend more time indoors together, you're gonna see increased spread. So I don't think any of this is really a surprise. You will note that the death rate, at least certainly based on reported cases, has continued to fall. I think the hospitalizations are up, but people aren't really, they're not going to intensive care units the way they did. And I think I think Dr. Fauci's representing a perspective that I guess I take issue with to some extent, as we've discussed in the past. I think there isn't all that much we can do, unfortunately, to prevent this virus. And I think people are protecting themselves in many respects. So older, sicker people are tending to avoid contact with others. That's part of the reason the death rate's falling. And the infections are skewing toward younger people, which, as some have pointed out, could in fact protect elderly people, because more and more people get infected, the virus has fewer places to go, and then it more or less ultimately burns out. So I think, I think we need to take a balanced approach. Life cannot stop. We can't shut down the world for 2 years, but for a virus that for most people represents a benign illness.
And what about, the kids? Do you think children will ever get vaccinated? Is there even a need for that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be last. And, it's kind of a controversial point. I mean, we don't really know. We don't have great long-term data on side effects. I don't want to scare people, because I think the risk versus benefits of getting the vaccine for many people certainly are in favor of the vaccine. But I don't think we have complete data. And I think there's definitely it definitely will make people feel sick. So I mean, I'm not sure that it certainly shouldn't be the highest priority. Look, if you were 25 years old, I don't know how old you are, but if you were 25, if I were 25, that, that's not even a child. You know, I'd kind of say, well, I don't know. Do I want to get two vaccines, take time out of my life, get sick for a couple days, if that's what it might do, for something that probably represents nothing more than kind of a flu-like illness I think you'd think twice about it. And I'm not trying. I'm not advocating. So please don't yell at me out there if you're upset with this. But I think that you have to understand what people's calculations are. And it's just like we saw the kids in Florida in the spring on spring break, you know, kind of ignoring it. And I think they before anyone else admitted it, they knew that for them it probably wasn't going to be a serious problem.
Well, but what you'll probably have happen to take this out of the realm of choice is mandates on vaccinations in order to do things like go to school. But speaking of kids, though, this you know, the unintended consequences, the opportunity costs that are so little discussed. This from in the pages of the New York Times, no less, stunningly, by an immunologist and a pediatrician or professor of pediatrics at Columbia. Quarantine may negatively affect kids' immune systems. And the authors suggest the world is unwittingly conducting what amounts to the largest immunological experiment in the history on our own children, keeping children inside, sanitizing their living spaces and their hands, and largely isolating them. In doing so, we're preventing large numbers of them from becoming infected or transmitting the virus. But we may also be unintentionally inhibiting the proper development of children's immune systems. And they mention the E word that shall not be spoken of, exposure, and that failing to train our immune systems properly can have serious consequences. And they talk about research both with respect to infants and peanut allergies as well as respect to mice raised in germ-free conditions versus mice who were not, and so on and so forth. So that not only are we potentially compromising our children's intellectual and social development with school lockdowns, but now we're potentially compromising their life expectancy by negatively impacting their immune systems and the development of their immune systems.
Yeah, so I think that's a real risk. And if you can look back to the Spanish flu epidemic in 1920, that was an H1N1 type of flu virus. And it's hypothesized that part of the reason the H1N1 epidemic that we had, just a few years ago, wasn't as severe was because it didn't impact elderly people. And the hypothesis is that those folks were infected with a similar strain during the Spanish flu and had immunity. And I think it should be well taken. In other countries, you know, some of the Asian countries, for example, one of the reasons that they may seem to have had fewer problems is because they have more exposures to similar antigens, similar viruses that create cross reactivity. I can't tell you that for sure, but you know, we all know if we go to some countries and we drink the water, for example, we get sick. The people there don't. We have immune systems for a reason, and I think attempting to shield. And put people in bubbles is not, it risks not ensuring proper development of our ability to protect ourselves.
He is Dr. Roger Klein, expert with the Regulatory Transparency Project's FDA and Health Working Group, former director of molecular oncology at the Cleveland Clinic, and former advisor to the FDA, CDC, CMS, and HHS. Dr. Klein, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. General Michael Flynn giving his first interview since his pardon over the weekend. His pardon just happened on Wednesday, of course, before Thanksgiving. And General Flynn had this to say about the slow-moving coup attempt that began 4 years ago and persists to this day. First, what started back in the 2016 campaign into the opening months of the Trump presidency and continued?
I mean, I think what we experienced over the last 4 years, and certainly late 2016, very late 2016 and early 2017 period, was a very strong effort to unseat a duly elected president and really try to remove Donald Trump by just political pressure, by technology pressure, by financial pressure early on in his tenure, maybe to get him to just say, you know what, I don't need this. I'm not going to put up with it and walk away. I think that there was some sentiment. In fact, I know there was some sentiment to maybe he'll just, you know, he's the guy from New York. He's never not a politician. He'll just say, you know what, I don't need this stuff. I got better things to do, and leave. And thank God that he didn't. And that then lasted. When he didn't, that then continued. That effort continued to go after him in any way possible to remove him through some means.
Flynn is right in his characterization. If you recall that time, there absolutely was this thread out being spun by the D.C. press corps that, as soon as the going gets tough, Trump, who's just a front-running reality TV star, is going to fade. He's going to say, this is too much. He's going to say, this isn't fun. This isn't easy like it was cracked up to be. When he realizes the magnitude of the job, he's going to wilt and go away. Of course, quite the opposite happened. He rose into the job. He grew with the job in so many ways, I would argue. And so they needed to go to plans B, C, and D, which is exactly what they did, from talking about the 25th Amendment with armchair psychologists on MSNBC saying the president doesn't have the mental capacity to be in the job, even though that these Yale psychiatrists had never spoken to the president in their life, to obviously the Mueller investigation and then the impeachment and everything that has transpired over the last 4 years. And Michael Flynn saying in that same interview, it persisted right up and through the election. Giving one example from the 2016 vanquished.
This is still a coup in progress, but now it's a little bit different. And it's sort of they upped their game. When they lost in 2016, I think that there was a decision, and I believe this, but there was some type of decision to say, we're not going to allow this to happen again. I mean, all you got to do is go back and listen to some of the comments this past summer from some of the senior people that are part of this Democratic Party, right? I mean, Hillary Clinton won, being, I think it was back in July or certainly mid-summer time frame, where she said, no matter what, Joe Biden should not concede. What are we talking about there? I mean, why would she say that in the middle of the summer, 3, maybe 4 months before an election?
And perhaps Republicans and conservatives and even many Trump supporters were slow to recognize the forces that were aligned against the president, the administration, their interests, really. Slow to recognize them for what they were. It's just hard to impute malicious motives onto other people. A lot of people have a difficult time doing that. Oh, we just disagree, but they're not really out to do me harm. Well, we mentioned this piece that was posted over at Powerline Blog, our friends John Hindraker and company over there, by David Horowitz last week, called Fighting Words. And David Horowitz, radical son, minces no words. Democrats are not Democrats. They are totalitarians. Progressives are not progressive. They are reactionaries. For more development of those statements, we're pleased to be joined by the aforesaid David Horowitz. He is the founder and president of the David Horowitz Freedom Center, editor of Front Page Magazine, and author of Blitz, Trump Will Smash the Left and Win. David Horowitz, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with those pronouncements. Democrats are not Democrats. They're totalitarians. Progressives are not progressive. They are reactionaries. Tell us.
Republicans have lost these political battles because there's a political war going on. The Democrats call Republicans racists, traitors. They call the President of the United States a traitor. Accuse him of killing 220,000 or now whatever it is, 250,000 coronavirus patients. And Republicans' response to that is, you can hear this from Kevin McCarthy all the time, oh, they're just playing politics. That's not playing. That's war. They're trying to kill you, and they're, sort of successful. Democrats are racists. Identity politics is racism. They're the traitors. They refuse to accept the results of the 2016 election. Our entire democratic system rests on recognizing that you settle things at the polls and accepting when you lose and, you know, organizing to win the next time. But the Democrats formed a resistance to Trump. That's where there's incredible division in our country. They've also fixed this election, as should be quite obvious. They're also character assassins. There isn't a significant Republican who hasn't been slandered, libeled, defamed, and you just interviewed one of them, by Democrats. Stop treating them with kid gloves. That's what I'm saying in this piece. You got to fight fire with fire.
So how do you fight totalitarians, reactionaries?
Why are they totalitarians? Well, identity politics wants to make everything political. It's not just that they want to have a dictatorship, which they do. The Democrats have worked relentlessly to develop a one-party system. They're against the Electoral College. They want to eliminate, it's in the Constitution. They want to eliminate, actually, the Senate. They want to pack the Supreme Court. You could go on and on with what they want to do. They want to have mail-in ballots that are easy to defraud. They don't want to have an election day. They want you to be able to vote for months. So it makes it easier, of course, to fix. They have declared war on our system, is what the Democrats have done. But identity politics is all-encompassing. So it's not just that they want to set up a one-party dictatorship, which they do. It should be obvious to everyone by now. But they want to control you right down to the pronouns you use. In Canada, they're already prosecuting people for not using the proper pronouns, say, to address transgendered people, criminalizing it. So it's like every aspect of life is under their strictures. They don't want you to go to church or synagogue during a virus epidemic, but it's okay to go to a liquor store or Walmart.
Right.
These people are very dangerous people. The leadership of the Democrat Party today are dangerous, dangerous people. And it's time for conservatives and patriots to recognize that and to fight it the way it needs to be fought. Don't be so polite and avoid saying, the only Republican I know that's called a Democrat a racist is Trump. And that was a black Democrat, Elijah Cummings. And he was right. Elijah Cummings made himself a millionaire running a district in Baltimore where, poverty is off the charts, the schools are rotten, and so forth. And he was there for 40 years, and what he did was enrich himself. If he had been a Republican, the Democrats would be calling him a racist. So
we have to give them a taste of their own medicine.
You have to have a taste of their own medicine. Mayor in your city, she's a brazen liar. She's addressing demonstrations where they say, hands up, don't shoot, about the Michael Brown case in Baltimore. Michael Brown's hands weren't up. That claim that he had his hands up when he was shot comes from his criminal accomplice. They had just committed a strong-arm robbery. Six black eyewitnesses testified to a grand jury, and this was investigated by the Obama Justice Department. Six black eyewitnesses testified that Michael Brown was charging the officer to take away his gun when he was shot, charging him.
Right,
you're like a war zone. What did you lose? 37 people, 37 shootings this weekend. I mean, come on.
Well,
this
right.
Woman and, is a horror.
Yeah, we're familiar with Lori Lightfoot and the parade of horribles in Chicago for many generations. But
she's black. Republicans are afraid to say anything because you have black skin privilege.
Well, so here's a question. So Shelby Steele's "What Killed Michael Brown" documentary is a good example of fighting back, to my mind.
Except that they censored it; they won't show it.
Well, I mean, but it's back up on Amazon.
Not only will they show it, but
I hear you. But I want to get to, since you know you come from the other side in the '60s to present, you have a particularly good perspective on this about how you combat fire with fire effectively, which is what you're speaking to. And I just want you to develop that a little bit more. You say, you know, don't be so polite, to speak truth plainly, take up the fight. But just, you know, for everyday people, what form does that take in terms of trying to wage this war on the level it needs to be
waged? For everyday
waged?
People, you have to stay, don't stray too far outside your comfort zone. But you got to be a lot tougher than you are now.
Okay.
Look, racism is racism. If the Democrats are appointing vice presidential candidates on the basis of their race, that's racism. You know, just say it. In the way you fight these political wars, you can't orchestrate everything you do on the basis of race. You know, every time there's an appointment come up, the Democrat Party is a racist party. You know, if they had a Supreme Court appointment, the battle would be, was it to be black, female, you know, all these things. This is not America. This is not, you know, the Constitution doesn't use the words white, black, male, or female, because the vision of the founders was that to create a society in which individuals were judged on their merits, not on their gender or their race.
Well,
the Democrat Party is an anti-American party.
All right. Well, let's talk about the 2020 election. How did the Democrats use COVID to their advantage?
Well, first of all, they accused the President of the United States. I thought our side just was weak in the fight back. They accused Trump of killing. Biden did this in the presidential debate, killing 220,000 coronavirus patients. Trump doesn't have control over a single healthcare system in this country. We have a federal system. The governors make the lockdown orders. The governors do the mask orders. That's the way our system works. So the only political figure you could actually accuse of killing people is Cuomo. Yeah. You certainly can't do that with Trump. This is a disgusting charge. Joe Biden is a pathological liar, and he's a nasty, nasty human being and the most corrupt candidate who ever ran for president.
I don't hear
that kind of language coming out of our side. Democrats have no compunction about calling us racists, sexists, traitors, and so forth.
Let me respond to the assertion that the left, this identitarian left you're describing, ultimately is going to be a snake that eats its own tail. And a good example of this just transpired over the weekend or last week before the holiday, which was Dianne Feinstein being demoted from the ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Because the Germans have a term for how we should react. It's called Schadenfreude.
Well, I get that part of it. No. I get that part of it. But the idea that she was demoted because she wasn't strident enough. This is somebody the dogma
because
lives loudly within you.
Lindsey Graham if for she's,
right.
A decent hearing.
Right. Right. So
this
so
is disgusting.
So no, I know, but wait, David, wait a second. So somebody as left as Dianne Feinstein, who essentially accidentally elevated Amy Coney Barrett, is there any merit to the argument that it's those examples show how the left is going to sort of inexorably marginalize itself?
Yeah, but look, they can do so much damage in the process.
Yeah.
Not to mention, I mean, they're going to go out to try to arm Iran again. You know, it took 70 years. The Soviet system was bankrupt from the start. It took 70 years to get rid of it. Think of all the lives that were ruined and the lives that they're going to ruin now, the Democrats, if they get enough power. So I don't think it's a good posture to say they're going to devour themselves and we don't have to do anything but watch them fall. I think we're in a good position, even if they steal this election, to fight. Although I'm worried about the Georgia Senate race. They're letting them, you know, they're going to steal that too. I mean, the Republicans just have to get a war mentality.
He is David.
I mean, that's the gist of what I've said in the article. It's time to go to war, people. If there's a Democrat that genuinely reaches out, every now and then there's a Joe Manchin, fine. But don't treat these people with kid gloves. Don't pretend that Joe Biden is not a corrupt liar and a character assassin. He accused Trump of being a racist. I mean, this is... 4 years into a Trump presidency, which has done more for black people than any other president, as he says, since Lincoln. That's true.
He is David Horowitz, founder and president of the David Horowitz Freedom Center, editor of Front Page Magazine, the book Blitz, Trump Will Smash the Left and Win, and check out his column again, Fighting Words, which I will tweet out at Dan Proft as well. David Horowitz, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Take care.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM 560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.